Now, I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Ruth S. from San Diego. Did I say that right? Beth, I'm sorry. Beth S. from San Diego.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic. If Ruth wants to get up here and speak, that would be just fine. That'd be great. I'm quite all right with that. Thank you for asking me to speak. It's not my favorite thing to do. I think the best part of speaking is when you get to sit down when it's over. That's the best feeling. But I've learned you just don't say no to request an Alcoholics Anonymous, because I heard it said the other night at my home group, I don't know which part of my program is what keeps me sober today. So I don't want to not do one part of it, because that might be the part. You know, I don't know. It's not up to me. So if it's in front of me, I'm going to do it. I never know where God's going to lead me, but I know as long as I follow where he leads, then I'm going to be okay. Let's see. I guess I'll start. My sobriety date is April 20th, 1997. My home group is the Tuesday night speakers meeting of Escondido, and my sponsor is Shirley M. Where to start? You know, I can't say I remember my first drink of alcohol. I know that's where a lot of people start in their story. I was a kid growing up in Phoenix. We lived in the suburb, and it's pretty hot in summertime. And, you know, my dad, I grew up in a pretty normal family. I mean, I think it's normal, and there were times where I felt we were very abnormal. There were times where I was really embarrassed, but I think that happens to a lot of us, a lot of people that aren't even alcoholic. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of... My dad liked to drink. He didn't drink a lot. He always had beer in the fridge. In the summertime, I remember he'd have the TV on. He'd be watching a game or whatever. And if he needed another drink, I wanted to be the one to get it for him, because he would let us pop the top and take the first swallow. So, I mean, to me, that tells me my dad's not an alcoholic. There's no way I would let somebody else take the first sip out of my can. But, you know, I still, to this day, even as a little kid, I remember how it looked when I would, you know, that was back, you know, you'd take the lid off and you just could see the bubbles coming up, you know, and I could smell it. And, you know, my dad didn't drink, you know, the good stuff. It was Pabst Blue Ribbon or whatever, whatever was on sale. But I liked it. I liked the taste of beer even when I was a little kid, you know. And I remember when I was a little older, the adults would come over and my dad would fix a drink, and there was something about the way that looked in the glass, you know, with the ice cubes and the dark and the light and the way it swirled around. And there was something about that, even before I knew what was in there or how it was going to make me feel, there was some sort of promise in that glass that that's what I was going to drink when I was a big person. You know, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be where that was going to be. And it wasn't like I wanted to leave where I was at, because I was a pretty happy kid. You know, life was life, and I did what I did, and I don't know, I was just a pretty happy kid. And, you know, I had two older sisters, a younger brother, and if they were too shy to ask the neighbors for something, you know, get Beth to do it, and I was fine. You know, I just did whatever you wanted me to do. It was no big deal. And, you know, went to school, very normal kid. But I remember as a kid seeing, like, you know, her name was Debbie, and she just knew how to play sports. And, like, the boys liked her, and she was just good. And she, like, never seemed to get angry at anybody. And the people just wanted to be her friend, and the teachers loved her. And I remember being in first grade, and I remember this. My mom was a teacher's aide in her classroom, and my mom came home and started talking about Debbie. And I was like, really? You know, like, there was just something. And I remember in fourth grade, Debbie and the kids, like, walking. And I just remember thinking, how did she learn how to do that? You know, make those friends. I just never quite got it, you know. And but then there were always those kids. And they just were so much, they just looked fun, you know. And I remember walking to school, like, sixth grade, and we'd be walking through the park, and there were the buildings in the park, and there were certain kids that hung out in those at those buildings before school. And I remember once walking by, and I was with my friend, and they called us over. And they were smoking, and they were hanging out, and I just thought, this is so cool. You know, those people were very cool. Debbie, I wish I could be like her, but I just didn't get it. Those people were way too cool for me. I just would hang around, like, kind of on the outskirts of them, because I thought any moment they would figure out that I just wasn't cool enough. So I couldn't do what Debbie did. I just wasn't good enough. With them, I wasn't cool enough. So, you know, I just kind of did my own thing. I would show up. If I could be who you wanted me to be, I'd show up and be that person. If I couldn't be who you wanted me to be, I would just find somewhere else where I might be able to fit in. So it was fine. I was okay kind of drifting along and doing whatever I needed to do to get by. And school was like that. I would do just enough to get by because I could. I was just smart enough to where I could kind of make it through. As I got into high school, you know, you study enough the night before the exam, you take the exam, it's over. I never quite got the fact that I was going to school to learn something. It was like, if I knew it, then I'm supposed to know it. If it comes easily, then it must be what I'm supposed to know. If it doesn't come quite so easily, it must not be that important, so I'll just leave that alone. I just didn't think life should be that hard. It shouldn't take that much effort, you know, and I didn't put a lot of effort into it, and I was okay. Until puberty. Puberty was hard. And I don't know what happened, but I remember about that time there was him. And I was in sixth grade, and I didn't even know much about that until after, like, I realized that the opportunity had passed, that he was gonna, like, be my boyfriend, but I didn't quite pick up on the cues, like when he said, "Would you be my girlfriend?" in sixth grade, and it didn't, like, "You're just kidding, right?" And I just, like, laughed it off, and then realized later he was telling me the truth. Like, he wanted me my boyfriend. You know, I chased that boy for the next 2 years. Like, wait, you know, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, you know, and you know, that was the first time that I really ever felt like if I could just talk to him today, I'll be okay. So can we just get home, Mom? Because I need to call him and leave him a message. I mean, I think he was my first real, I'm going to be okay if that. You know, and God, I remember, like, having that terror in my gut that if we don't get home so I could call him. I mean, thank God, you know, he tolerated me. We knew each other for a really long time, and he put up with my phone calls. He was never really mean. I mean, he didn't know how important he was to me. Or maybe he did, and he tolerated it. You know, we were friends, you know, but he was really, I had to have that connection to him every single day. And, you know, and it's funny because we've reconnected later in life. And in college, I saw him one time, and I looked at him, and there was something wrong with his eyes. And I'd heard he'd had, you know, some trouble through the years. And I found out, you know, that difference in his eyes was that was his addiction to heroin. You know, my first drug was, you know, him. And he went on to his own drug of choice, you know, and then now we're Facebook friends, actually, and we keep in touch, and I know he struggles today, but I know he's sober today. I'm really glad about that. But anyway, so back to back then, you know, I got through that and went on to high school, and I met another him, and that didn't quite work out, and then I met another him, and he led me to alcohol. You know, and you know, I had been introduced to alcohol. I knew the deal, and it was fine. You know, and my dad was always very accommodating. I was in high school, and you know, I'd have a bad day at work at the mall, and I'd call him, and he'd have some you know, coolers in the fridge when I got home, because in my dad's world, like, if he let me have a drink at home, then I wasn't going to go out somewhere else and get in trouble. You know, he's so nice. Anyway, so, you know, these things all worked. I mean, and, you know, junior or senior in high school, you know, we did the crazy stuff, and yeah, I'd, did some really crazy stuff, and I would overshoot the mark, and then I met another him, and finally it was working out, but he was off at the university, and I was still in high school, and they would have these parties, and that's when somebody finally told me that he really didn't want me to drink that much. That's when I really started getting in trouble. I mean, I did stupid stuff. I drink too much. I'd throw up or whatever. And, got caught in the park with the alcohol. Whatever. I think those are just bad judgment calls, bad decisions. It's a kid thing to do. But that was the first time that anybody ever pointed out to me that I changed when I was drinking and that he didn't like who I was changed into. I liked who I was changed into. By the time it got to that point, there was no way you were going to get me to want to stop, or he was going to get me to want to stop. But I was still, he was fixing me. I had him, and I wasn't going to not have him. So we did that dance of death for, a number of years. I was 17 when we started dating, and I was 25 when I finally moved to San Diego. And that was my geographic. I moved to San Diego because my relationship with my boyfriend wasn't working out really well, and I just couldn't figure out how to break up with him. So I moved here, I got a job that could transfer me out here, and it was great. I got this job, and what did I do? I interviewed for the job. It was a company that I'd been working for, I know how to interview. Like I said, I know how to do what you want me to do or be who you want me to be. I know how to take a test well. I know how to interview and kind of answer the right way. And I don't know what kind of instinct or where I got that set of rules. But I knew how to do that. I guess I'd figured that out. And I convinced them that I knew how to do that job that they sent me out here to do. Because I thought that's what you did in a job interview. You tell them what you need to tell them in order to get the job. You want the job, right? So I get out here, and I couldn't do the job. And there were people relying on me to do that job, and I was the boss. I don't know how to be responsible. I don't know how to take responsibility. I don't know how to get you to do what I want you to do. I'm like that person that just kind of goes through life, oh, well, that's nice. Okay, guys, work harder. Time to get home. And I just didn't know how to be in charge. But then I was faced with that I was going to fail, And the owners of the company flew out, and they sat me down, and they said, look, this isn't working out. You got to shape up or ship out. And I don't know what they told me, but what I heard was you just need to tell them what you need them to do, and they're going to have to do it. You get them to be done at a certain time, and they're going to have to be done at a certain time. And it was something switched, And around that time, not at that time, maybe before that time, that's when my drinking changed. I used to get in trouble drinking, and I had that personality change, when you drink a little too much, you become who you really want to be or you think who you want to be. Now I needed to drink. I would get home. My days were hard, and they were long, and I had never had to have any responsibility before that point, and I was in charge. And, there's a part in the big book, and it said, lack of power, that was our dilemma. And I really felt every single day that I just didn't have enough power. They didn't respect me. You're not listening to me. You're disrespecting me. And somehow I needed more power. You just need to listen to what I have to do. It's crazy. And so I would just exert more power. That part in chapter 3 about if everybody would just do their part, everything would be great. But what usually happens, they know you're just being manipulative. They know that really you're just in it for yourself. You care nothing about their well-being. And that's really how I was. I cared nothing about my staff's well-being. I cared nothing about how I treated them. And they didn't know who they were going to get from one day to the next. Because one day everything would be okay. We'd have a good day. Maybe it was a good day. I don't know. I'd get home that night and I'd need a drink. And I would drink. And then I'd start thinking. And something would pop in my head that happened that day. And I knew what they meant by that. And then I'd start thinking that they're out to get me. And somehow it went from whatever it was to whatever I thought it was going to be and whatever they were planning. And the next day there was hell to pay. And I lived that way for a while. They didn't want to drink with me. They were the only people I knew here. So I just drank different. It wasn't fun anymore. I had to drink. And, then that relationship ended finally. Yeah, he was still back in Phoenix. But, I don't know. There isn't a lot of glamour to my drinking. There isn't a lot of, I don't know. It was just lonely and small, and I was tired. Just so tired. And, I got really good at that job. I got pretty successful. I made that switch in my mind, and I did what I needed to do to get by. And what I needed to do was I needed to push everybody around me just that much harder. And I developed the attitude, if you just ask people to do enough, they will do it. No matter how hard you push them, they will get there if you just push them the right way, if you just manipulate the right way. And if you can't cut it, you're out. And, willpower and self-will and all that kind of stuff and manipulation, I think I turned things around. And there was a point at which I thought I had it all. And 6 months later, I was in desperate need of help. And I was crying every night. And I was in another relationship by this time with a really nice guy. And I believe that, I believe today that somehow that guy came in my life so that I could learn that no matter what, if you get the right guy, you're still not going to be fixed. Because I had the right guy. And finally he said to me, you're really going to need to do something because I can't make you happy. I'm really starting to feel like a failure. So I was crying all the time. I had no idea it had anything to do with my drinking. My drinking is what helped me get by. My days were hard, And all that time I was trying, oh my gosh, my company sent me to Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends, Influence People. I really tried in that one. But, after a couple drinks, those books, you just can't get through them. I couldn't remember them the next day. And there was another management one I had to take. And by that time I was drinking a lot. And there was no way I could understand what I was reading. And so I'll go to a therapist. And I went to a therapist and went to see him for a few months. And finally he gave me a prescription for something and started taking that. And there would be times where I would be sitting there just thinking, God, I should be feeling something right now. I feel nothing, and I couldn't laugh anymore. And then it's changed. My drinking changed. The bottle said, no, do not drink alcohol on this medication. What I read was that you probably shouldn't. And it was really that important for me not to drink while taking this medication. The doctor probably should have said something about it, And I don't think long about these thoughts. It's a few seconds of like, well, really, So I just kept drinking and life was still hard. And now my drinking's a little different, and I'm doing other things on this medication that's probably not making that medication very effective. So finally the doctor, kind of knew I was numb and wasn't crying anymore. So I went to him one last time, and it was January of 1997, And I went to see him one more time, and we're sitting on his couch, and we're talking for a while, and he said, well, Kay, what are you here for? Why are you back? And we're talking for a while, and in my mind, I'm thinking, but it's not okay still. I just don't laugh anymore, and I don't cry anymore, but I'm still not okay. And, my family, there's mental illness in my family, and it's whatever it is. It's on both sides of my family. And I remember there'd be times where I was just laying in bed thinking, I can't be crazy. I just can't be crazy. I can be anything but crazy. I don't want to be crazy. And, because I just had this, like, I just was not going to be crazy. And So I just was going, but I'm seeing a therapist, and he says, well, so why, what can I do for you? And I said, well, you know, I never did stop drinking on that medication. And what I was trying to tell him was that it isn't working, because it can't be working because I'm drinking on it. So maybe maybe I need to see you a little bit longer so that we can talk about this a little more, because that medication's not working. Something's not right. And something clicked in his mind, because I didn't realize it, that I'm seeing a drug and alcohol counselor. But in all the times that I'd been seeing him, he had no idea how much I drank. And so a light went on in his head, and he said, really, is that why you came to see me? Well, let's take a test. So he pulls out the little questions, you know, and he asks me the little questions. And he says to me, well, you know, I think you're a borderline social drinker, maybe a problem drinker. I'm borderline. And that gave me hope. I have a problem. Okay, I'm a borderline problem drinker. Do you know I told people that? I was like proud, like I am a borderline problem drinker. I'm great. And he said, maybe you should go to a few AA meetings. You know, that's where people go that don't want to drink anymore. They need to find, you know, I don't know what I heard. Somehow I figured I could go to Alcoholics Anonymous even though I wasn't an alcoholic. I'm a borderline problem drinker. And I don't know. Since then, I've never heard of that test that actually tells you if you're borderline, but he knew what he had to tell me, you know, and I'm grateful for him today, because I went to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and wasn't an alcoholic, but I was telling someone before the meeting, you know, it was one of those beginner's meetings where they have everybody stand up that's a newcomer, and you sit down if you have 10 days, and you sit down if you have 8 days or whatever. Last man standing. And so I got the book. I wasn't alcoholic, but they gave me the book and asked us to keep coming back, and went back the next week. I liked what I heard there. There was drama. A guy got pissed off. He, you know, cussed off the meeting. He had to leave the room. And I'm like, yes. You know, it was like those people standing in the buildings at the park. You know, like the cool people that I just wasn't cool enough to be. And you know, that was kind of like my whole life. You know, I didn't quite fit in, but if you just let me hang around, then I'll be okay. You know, and that job that I had for all those years, I finally made it to be the boss. I worked my way up to be the boss and in charge. I kept wondering when they first hired me, when they were going to figure out that I wasn't cool enough to really work there. You know, I wasn't good enough to work there. I wasn't good enough and cool enough to be like them, but I figured it out to how to be in charge. You know, I never knew how to just be in the middle and be one of you and one of those around me, you know. And so I went to AA for a while, and finally things started to make a little bit of sense. I started to get a little hope here, but I still kept just showing up to meetings, hearing what I needed to hear, thinking that I could just take some of that with me and, like, apply it out there, you know. And I bought a big book, and I would read that, and I was still doing some other substances. And, you know, that big book just made a lot of sense when I was doing those other things. I just couldn't remember the next day what I read. But I remember just thinking, wow, this is so cool, you know, and relating. And a lot of it, I think, was, you know, we agnostics and more about alcoholism. And chapter 5, the part after the steps, you know, that we hear at every single meeting. Because, you know, the steps, like how it works, and all of those things, and God could and would, and he was thought, that all encompasses up through step 2. The best part of the big book, in my experience, is right after that, and that's step 3. That's where I found myself in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Finally, I read step 3 in the big book. That described me. It had nothing to do about my drinking at all. It described my living. How to win friends and influence people never made sense to me. It never worked. Because step 3, I needed step 3. And, you know, and it wasn't about me. And it wasn't about me trying to get other people to do what they needed to do. And that's when I believed AA had something for me. And that you were going to help me with that part of it. And, you know, and I related to that part of the big book. But, you know, I didn't stay sober after that. took a few more months of coming here and listening and taking what I needed and leaving the rest. And finally one night I had that moment of clarity where the lie that my brain had told me of why it was okay to do what was not okay, that did count in sobriety, that you don't do those things and keep your sobriety date, it counted, you know. And the next day, I got honest with another member of this program. I'd never reached out or gotten honest with anybody here before. I never let you know who I was. I always let you know who I wanted you to think I was, you know. And I didn't open up. I didn't know how to share. I didn't know how to fit in or be one of you or be one of many. So the next day I got honest with another member of AA, and you know, and he left it up to me how it was going to be. And the next morning I woke up and something was different. I got up and I walked outside and the colors were different. The sky was different. And I knew that was my sobriety date. I had never remembered my sobriety date before then. You know, it wasn't, I don't know. I never knew when I was going to, I just didn't hold on to the day, you know. And I knew that was going to be my sobriety day. And it is still today. And, you know, and that's not to say the life got easy. You know, it still was really hard. I still didn't know how to be one of you or one of many or average. You know, I always was either less than, not cool enough, not good enough, not smart enough, whatever, just not enough, or I was going to be better than. I was going to struggle to the top. I was going to judge you or to be better than. I just didn't know how to be in the middle, you know, and it took a while. But, you know, I'm glad for that. I'm glad for the slow process of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and the beauty of that is that that now, you know, coming to AA for a few years and staying in San Diego this time, I get to see people that I've known over time, that have been here before me, that have come in after me, and you get to witness that change. And it's just, you know, heartwarming for that. And I love that. And then eventually I get to see once in a while the change in myself, that I'm not that same person that I used to be. You know, it's been 15 years since I got sober. And, finally I now feel like the manager of others that I was supposed to be back when I first moved to San Diego. That, you know, I couldn't be the manager or the boss that those people needed to be me to be for them. And I had no idea that they needed anything from me. Never thought about that. All I thought about was what I needed from them. And now part of the best part of my job is that the people that work for me and report to me is that I get to help them grow and become, you know, the employee that they can be or that they want to be. And I find that, like, part of the most rewarding part of my job. And, you know, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, the way we learn that is first by being a sponsee and becoming a sponsor, you know, and listening to people in meetings and watching them grow and just letting it be about somebody else and not about you anymore. So anyway, so that guy that I opened up to early on in my sobriety, I'd asked him, you know, if, you know, does that count? You know, am I going to give up my sobriety date? Well, I didn't remember what my sobriety date was, but I didn't want to give it up, you know. And he left it up to me. At first he told me, no, that's really bad. No, you don't get high, and it does count. And, you know, and he said, but you know, I know people in AA that do, and they're sober in their world, and they can be, you know, it's just up to them. I don't know anybody in AA that gets high and, you know, shares that into me. But that's what he told me. So, okay. But I knew in that moment, what I'm so grateful for today is that he put the responsibility back on me, that I had to be honest with myself, that I had to be honest with him and honest with myself. And I think that's what got me started in Alcoholics Anonymous and kept me sober today, is that, you know, that to thine own self be true. That's not always very easy. But not only do I have to be honest with myself, but I have to be honest with you too. And I don't always want to be honest, but that's part of my job, here. So anyway, it's funny because, a big part of, my growth has been about my job. And I remember when I was new, I was sharing about that in a meeting, how I hated my job it's just this and that. And I remember what I said, but I was just complaining about that. And a woman came up after me. She had a lot of time. She said, you know, there's a part in the big book, if you read it, and it, you know, when we took such a tack that we will have a new employer. You know, I wanted a new employer. I wanted a new job. So I picked up the big, and I read that part, and I thought there was some sort of code in there, you know. Like, okay, what do I, you know, I know it's saying that, but really, what does it mean, you know. And I look at that today, and that's come true for me, you know. And I believe that my God, or the God that I have in my life today, has led me to where the job that I'm supposed to have. You know, and a few months ago, I was trying to leave that job because I was just not happy there. And I thought I was supposed to go back to this old job that I had, and it was all, like, supposed to be part of God's plan. And isn't that, like, beautiful? It's so ironic, and I'm going to go back to that. And I showed up, and I got to work, and I was telling him I was leaving. And I had the opportunity one more time to be honest when I really didn't want to be honest. And I sat down with somebody at work that has, a position of influence, and he asked me why I was leaving, and I had to be honest. And I didn't want to be honest. That was probably going to make some people unhappy, you know, and I don't know, I wasn't prepared for that. But I learned here, you have to be honest even when you don't want to, even sometimes when it's uncomfortable. And I wasn't trying to throw somebody under the bus. I was just talking about my own experience, and I just, you know, laid it on the line. And so, you know, God changed the plan, and I'm still at that job. And because of that honesty, I don't always get to be comfortable at work, you know. And I've ruffled some feathers, and I've probably given a dose of truth to some people that really didn't want to hear it. But you know, that's not my problem today. It's my problem, but you know, I don't get to fix it today. I have to walk through that and be a big girl, you know, and realize that not everybody's going to like me every day. I have to be me, and there's only one me, you know, and I get to be that person here. And then now I get to carry that out and just side into the world, you know. Gosh, I don't know. I'm kind of running out of things to say. I guess I should tell you, outside of work, I have another life. I am still married to that guy that I wasn't married back then. We were living together, and I finally got sober. And he stuck with me, and he was very supportive of me going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was very grateful that you were going to do for me what I needed. And he was very grateful for all the things that I got out of the meetings that I went to. And it was funny, though, because 1 year, actually it was probably within the first year of me being sober. We got married when I was 4 months sober. I don't recommend that, but we did. And I came home from work one day, and it was so funny. He had this look on his face like he had just, like, messed up so bad that I was going to be so mad. He'd gotten pulled over doing some things that we're not supposed to do when we're driving. And actually, he turned the corner and he exhaled, you know, just as the cop was. I know I'm not supposed to talk about that stuff here, but it's happened, you know. So anyway, he got sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so grateful because, you know, I got to be the greeter. And he had to go put his slip up at the front on the podium. And I was so grateful for the things he got to hear in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and the other 12-step program. He doesn't do that stuff anymore. And it's not because of the program that he's used. You know, it was because of my program that a couple years into our marriage, I had to decide, what was right in my life. And it wasn't an easy decision to make, and I had to talk to my sponsor about that, and got to the point where it wasn't okay for me to be married to somebody that did that anymore, and that's just my experience. It may be okay for somebody else. It's just my experience. You know, I want somebody that's present, and when I look in their eyes, I can see them, and I can know they're looking back at me, and so I worked through that with my sponsor, and I knew I loved him, and I would not want to do anything in the world to hurt him. So we worked through it, and I just had to tell him, this is it. This is what's right for me, and now it's your choice. And I had to leave the choice in his hands. And he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to argue about it. He just made his choice. I'm really grateful for the choice that he made. I would not have been able to make that choice. You know, I needed to come to AA. I needed all of you. I needed to really hit a bottom. Anyway, so I said to my sponsor, but what if I think he's done something? You know, what if? You know, all these things. And she said, you don't get to ask him. It's not your business. If he says he's not going to do it, leave it alone. So I had to leave that alone, you know, and we're still married today, and I like to say that we've both grown up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had to grow up. You know, you hear the term normie a lot here, and there is no way I would ever describe my husband as a normie. If he was a normie, he would not have been hanging out with someone of the likes of me, you know. We were very good for each other, but he was by no means a normie. But, you know, we're very normal and boring today. And we're both kind of geeks today, you know. We both, like, very much like Star Trek and space movies. And, you know, we just went to Prometheus and we just had a great time. And we have a daughter today and she's 8 years old. Thank you. And, you know, and her first imaginary friend was Captain Kirk. So we're, you know, just raising another Trekkie in this world. And, you know, it's a nice little boring life that we have, but it's my life, and I absolutely love my life. You know, it's very simple, and it's funny. My daughter has her own troubles, her own struggles with life, and she's just quirky enough to be my daughter. But, you know, the beauty of it is I know here how to celebrate other people and how to celebrate our differences and how to celebrate our uniquenesses and just try and, you know, offer that kind of help. And I don't know what's in store for her. I don't know, you know, it's really hard. I don't know any other parents, but, you know, you're trying to see, like, are there any symptoms? You know, like, should I, like, start saving a seat? You know, and how can I, like, you know, what can I do to kind of prevent her from ever, you know, needing that drink? And I have to really be honest with myself. There's absolutely nothing in the world that I can do to prevent her from maybe someday needing Alcoholics Anonymous. But I really hope that I don't mess up her chance of getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the thing is, I don't even know if I would do that. I don't know. I don't know what the right thing is to do. All I know is that I can trust that I have the best intentions, that I'm just trying to be the mom that God wants me to be and do the best that I can. And when I mess up, you know, admit it promptly and say, I'm sorry. You know, it's that journey that we're all on here together, and you know, someday hopefully I'll look back at this and not be too hard on myself, you know, how I was during this era. You know, I asked my sponsor tonight on the way here if she has any advice for me, and she just said, you know, be honest, don't make it bigger than it was or smaller than it was, and just have fun. And I hope I've done that here, and I hope that you have fun here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope that you find here what I have found here, which is just that measure of peace, that measure of peace and comfort and hope that I got here when I was new and that I still have here today. Thank you. All right.